Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, April 22nd. I'm Lisa Music reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Humboldt eases clampdown on Kernan construction, building a relationship with fire in 10 Mile Creek, and lawsuit challenges President Trump's new immigration rule. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. Would-be burglars attempted to gain entry into a Eureka-based cannabis distro in the early hours this morning, April 22, 2025. However, a robust security system and quick-responding officers from the Eureka Police Department had the attempted burglars fleeing from the scene. KMA News obtained surveillance video of the attempted break-in, where six suspects entered onto the business property, where two of the suspects, armed with bright yellow crowbars, attempted to pry open a door to the business. Three other individuals can be seen on the surveillance video on the perimeter of the business. With the alarm blaring and the cameras recording, the suspects abandoned their nefarious plans and casually walked off. EPD was notified immediately of the attempted burglary, responding quickly. Additional area law enforcement also responded to the call, providing assistance to EPD, including the California Highway Patrol, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, the Arcata Police Department, and the Fortuna Police Department. KMA News has confirmed that several of the suspects have been located and arrested. However, the investigation is ongoing. The incident comes amid a sharp rise in cannabis business burglaries across California. According to MJBiz Daily, licensed cannabis operators in the state reported 329 burglaries with losses in 2022, more than double the 147 reported in 2021. This alarming trend has persisted into 2023 and 24. With hotspots including Humboldt and Mendocino counties experiencing clusters of break-ins involving multiple suspects and organized theft rings. In 2024, California Attorney General Rob Bonta announced the arrest of 22 individuals tied to organized burglaries targeting cannabis businesses across nine counties, underscoring the scale and coordination of some of these crimes. However, the suspect's attire may suggest inexperience. One individual was seen wearing a distinctive bright reddish-pink sweatshirt with white floral pattern, while another used his sweatshirt to cover his hands, an apparent, if inefficient, attempt to avoid leaving fingerprints. Several suspects were wearing open-toed slides, further indicating a lack of preparation for a quick retreat. The burglars appeared ill-prepared for the task, particularly in the face of the distribution center's robust security system and the swift response from law enforcement, which led to several arrests within hours of the attempted break-in. In a text exchange with KMA News, an owner of the business expressed immense gratitude for the quick and thorough response of law enforcement across the county. To view the surveillance video, please visit kmud.org. If you have any information on this incident, contact EPD at 707-441-4300. A major Humboldt County construction company has gotten some relief on county actions against its permit. Daniel Mintz reports.
After a three-hour hearing, the permit of one of Humboldt County's most well-known construction services companies was changed, but not nearly as much as some neighbors and their district supervisor were calling for. Changes to the conditional use permit for the Glendale-based Kernan Construction Company were up for consideration at the April 15th Board of Supervisors meeting. Two areas of concern were prominent: environmental issues related to unpermitted construction of a berm, and what the county and neighbors described as nuisance issues stemming from noise and hours of operation. On the table were recommendations to direct Kernan to move the berm, do restoration work, address noise levels, and restrict the hours of all the company's operations to 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Representing Kernan, Land use attorney Brad Johnson told supervisors, "The recommendations tread on unstable legal terrain, particularly with the noise and hours changes."
One thing that the board has not heard is what the legal rules are. It's a bit like being asked to referee a sports game without being told what sport it is or what the rules are. You're being set up to make bad calls. And the problem is, if you make a bad call here, that can be unlawful, and that can also expose the county to some serious liability. So it's important to understand what's going on with this proceeding. This use permit that we're talking about is not just any use permit. It is a fundamentally vested use permit. It's a use permit that Kernan has expended millions of dollars in furtherance of and has operated pursuant to for more than 24 years. So that is what's known as a fundamental vested right. The county cannot revoke this use permit without notice of fair and impartial hearing. And there are specific standards that apply to what an impartial hearing is, and a valid evidentiary basis based on substantial evidence. It's not just complaints.
During a public comment period, Kernan supporters, including its employees and employees of other construction-related companies, said approving the new restrictions would cripple Kernan's ability to do its work and set a precedent that will negatively impact construction work countywide. Residents of Glendale Drive supporting the staff recommendations said noise impacts have intensified in recent years. They said they're not seeking to put Kernan out of business, a claim made earlier by Johnson, but rather to bring noise below nuisance levels. Last December, the board considered permit actions, and that hearing was continued to last week's meeting to allow time to work out mutual resolution of the various issues. The outcome of those negotiations was discussed in this exchange between Supervisor Rex Bone and Planning Director John Ford.
It sounds like the communications between Kernan and Planning and Building broke down. Would that be a fair assumption, or?
Yeah, I don't know what happened. We had what I thought was a fairly productive meeting. We talked about how to try to formulate a plan to bring back to the board. And it had two components to it, to do, what to do with the berm and what to do with noise and hours of operation. The representatives of Kernan wanted to go and negotiate with CDFW to determine what an acceptable setback would be from the creek. That was where that was left in that meeting, is they were going to have that conversation and get back to us. And then we'd ask that they address how we can meet their needs for their operational hours and noise, but also try to give some protection to the community to take some of the edge off. And they were supposed to come back to us with that. In response, we got a revised grading plan in response to the previous comments that the building division had made on the grading permit application, and it showed the berm in the same place. So at that point, we took that as the answer.
After a lot of discussion, a motion was developed that forged compromise. The motion retained recommended requirements to move the berm and do riparian buffer enhancement work, but it removed the limit on hours operation. Glendale Drive is in Supervisor Steve Madrone's district, and he strongly opposed the motion. He said one neighbor told him in an email that she, quote, got to the point of almost wanting to commit suicide due to relentless noise that went on for months at a time. Madrone said other neighbors have been impacted as well.
And those folks have talked often about how it has disrupted their sleep. They have not had any peace. It's not just about the noise during the day. It's noise all night long that was never really considered to be a factor in the operation of this business. It wasn't until suddenly this lower yard started hauling soils all night long that all of this came about. And this motion in front of us does nothing to impact that. You're basically allowing those kinds of operations to occur without any justification. Anytime it's determined that it's a contract that Kernan wants to take, whatever the reason is for that, you're allowing that to basically continue. So I just want to be really clear. I will be voting no, and I don't believe that this motion in front of us deals with, as I've said, the number one reason why we're even here today. And I find that to be just outrageous, frankly.
But the motion was approved, with Madrone casting the only vote against it. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Turning to Mendocino, a prescribed burn is planned for the lower 10 Mile Creek area this coming weekend. The burn is a collaboration between Torchbearer, CAL FIRE, landowners, and the Eel River Recovery Project. KMUD News spoke with Alicia Littletree Bales, community organizer with the Eel River Recovery Project, about the upcoming prescribed burn.
We're required to notify everybody when we are going to be doing a burn, and we've been doing a lot of burning out on Hargis Road, which is north of Laytonville, about 5 to 7 miles, and we're in the lower 10 Mile Creek watershed, and we'll be burning on Saturday. This is our second burn on this particular unit, and the first burn was in October, and it was a understory burn. So we've been doing both pile burning in the areas that have been thinned, and that's in preparation for doing these understory broadcast burns, which are extremely exciting and really amazing for the forest to bring fire back to the forest ecosystem in these areas.
This weekend's burn is part of a much larger project that includes outreach to local landowners, a role that Bales is tackling.
What I do is that I reach out to local community members around the 10 Mile watershed, which is in Laytonville, around their prescribed burning aspect of the Forest Health Grant project. They have 900 acres that they're working on, and this is a really exciting project because it's not just one big landowner like a timber company or a park or BLM. It is a number of small landowners who come together to collaborate, including with the Caddo tribe, to collaborate on a 900-acre forest health project. And that includes forest health thinning and also prescribed and cultural burning.
The planned burn area is located near Highway 101, approximately 7 miles northwest of Laytonville.
So Saturday's burn is going to be an understory burn in the lower 10 Mile. It's on about 13 acres. It is a lot of tan oak hardwood, these sort of maturing tan oak trees. So they do have quite a lovely canopy. It's not like when the trees are growing back and they're very dense and small. This is quite a mature stand. The landowner has done a lot of work himself to prep the area. And we're looking at, we're going to try to burn about 13 acres. And of course, the point is always fire hazard reduction and also forest health. So we're hoping to open up the understory for the health of the trees themselves and also for the beneficial use of wildlife while also reducing those dry wildfire fuels that have built up in our forest ecosystem since the suppression of fire and the removal of native fire from these landscapes. And it's just a really exciting thing to be there while the fire is happening and doing its work. So, so people may see smoke in the area just north of Laytonville when you're on that rattlesnake grade. You may see it off to the west there, and you can look at that and just feel excited that good fire is returning to this watershed.
Bill shared the environmental benefits of prescribed and cultural burning.
There's a lot of benefits to bringing prescribed fire to an area, and this is it's a different attitude of fire than the catastrophic fires that we have, seen so much about and experienced so many consequences from. This is low, slow, very polite fire, and it goes through the forest understory. And among other benefits, one of the most amazing things that it does is that it converts the down debris, right, the branches and the leaves and the dead trees and all that, it converts it into usable nutrients for the forest soils, right? So it's a generator of nutrients and life for the forest. Another thing that in this area in particular that I've been really interested in and looking at is the relationship with the prescribed fire with the oak trees. When we burned in October, I went back in a couple of weeks later just to see what had happened to the acorns, right? Because we do have weevils in the acorns or oak moths, I guess we can also call them, right? So I went back in and I looked at the effect on the acorn drop 2 weeks after we had burned in the understory, and I was able to collect several pounds of acorns with no weevils in them. And I've always heard about this beneficial effect of fire on the oak trees and the tan oaks in particular. And I was able to experience that with my own eyes. And also, you know, I ate them. So that, that was another benefit. So there's a lot of really wonderful results of fire. This burn in April is going to be a springtime burn, which is very different than a fall burn. So in the springtime burns, I think some of the benefits are, you know, a reduction in invasive plants, because this is when those invasive species like Scotch broom or French broom, those are putting on their seed heads, and some of the invasive grasses and other plants, the blackberry and that kind of thing. You burn in the spring to try to address the spread of those invasives and things like that. And so there's just, you know, burning at different times of the year has different benefits.
In recent years, among devastating and record-breaking fire seasons, land stewards are looking to native use of fire as the key to forest health and management.
Everybody knows fire needs to be back on the landscape, whether it's prescribed burning or cultural burning. But the reality of making that happen is it takes such a huge mindset shift. You know, we are used to thinking of fire as something that's terrifying. Right. And, you know, only you can prevent forest fires. And, you know, we've got to, if you're, you know, the utility, you want to like cut down every tree around the power line because trees equal fire. And that's just not a mindset that can take us into the future. Like, we need to be bringing fire into these areas in a holistic and healing way. And it can be very transformational, both for the forest and for the people.
The project is ongoing and will last for at least 3 years, utilizing collaboration to build a relationship with the ecosystem.
Of course, bringing fire back to the landscape is not just a one and done. It's a relationship that we're rekindling with the landscape. And so this is a long-term relationship, you know, and a long-term commitment. So burning, just, you know, coming back in and watching the results of it is essential. And we want to do it respectfully. We want to do it intelligently, and we want to do it in a way that doesn't cause harm. So the observations after the fact and the real deep relationship with the place are also important.
Funding for the 10 Mile Creek Watershed Forest Health Project was provided by Cal Fire's Forest Health Program.
One of the really neat things about it has been this collaboration between Elk Ridge Tree Service and Torchbearer. And Elk Ridge is a local business that has grown in as a result of this money coming into our community. These Cal Fire Forest Health grants have really been an opportunity, not just for forest health, but also for economic development. And Elk Ridge Tree Service has just been a great partner. They have hand crews hard at work every day out there doing the thinning and piling and getting the areas ready. And then Torchbearer is a nonprofit outfit that is led by certified burn boss Scott Steinbring, who's just been an amazing ally and advocate for this kind of grassroots burning. And he's been, you know, in fire his whole life, and he just sees the state of the woods and just, you know, is really just takes it seriously that we've got to be bringing fire back to these places. So anytime he has a chance to burn, he'll be out there burning anytime when conditions are right. So that's been an incredible collaboration, and I think, you know, keep an eye on this project because it's really exciting, and it provides an example for what communities can do with the money coming down from the state. Like, we really can get ourselves in a position to use it in ways that we feel are the best, rather than, you know, relying on the agencies to decide. It's like, this is a true grassroots effort.
This project requires participation from landowners, and community input and participation is encouraged.
We are always, this is part of the mindset shift, right? Is to bring people out and empower them with fire. This particular burn on Saturday is going to be a small crew of folks, but in general, we are looking, we do a lot of trainings with fire, particularly pile burning and biochar. It's been really a fun process. But we are always looking for folks who are interested in experiencing prescribed fire. You want to see how it works. You know, there are opportunities through this project for that. And also, if you're interested in bringing prescribed fire to your landscape, into your neighborhood and your watershed, that's another big part of it. And so if you if you are interested in that and volunteering with Eel River Recovery Project, you can give us a call at 707-223-7200, or you can go on our website or visit our Facebook page, which is Eel River Recovery Project on Facebook.
Or contact Alicia Bales at 916-595-8724. This Earth Day, elected officials promote California bill to make polluters pay. Elected officials from across California have signed onto a letter urging passage of a bill to make oil and gas companies pay into a super fund. It would help cities recover from natural disasters related to climate change and make them more resilient. Suzanne Potter reports.
As of today, Earth Day, more than 50 elected officials have signed a letter urging California lawmakers to make oil and gas companies bear the cost of climate change. The California Polluters Pay Superfund Act, which goes before the State Senate Judiciary Committee today, would assess a fee on large oil and gas companies to pay for programs that mitigate damage from climate change. Ahmad Zahra, a council member from Fullerton, signed on to the letter sponsored by the group Elected Officials to Protect America.
Throughout the years, these large oil companies were really not necessarily telling the truth about air pollution. And just like we've seen in oil spills and ground pollution, the responsible party has to pay for it.
The Western States Petroleum Association opposes the bill, saying it would lead to higher gas prices. The bill directs the California Environmental Protection Agency to determine how much climate change has cost the state from 1990 to 2024. Federal data show that California has suffered 46 natural disasters linked to climate change since 1980, each resulting in more than $1 billion in losses, with $250 billion from the L.A. firestorm alone. Marisol Rubio, a council member in San Ramon, says 40% of the funds would be directed to low-income communities most affected by fossil fuel pollution.
Those funds can then be used to better manage and correct and abate the pollution that not only already exists, but that will come inevitably in the future until we are able to be independent of fossil fuels.
Advocates say right now, everyday Californians foot the bill for climate change in the form of higher taxes, insurance rates, and utility bills, as well as via medical expenses for pollution-related illness. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, earlier this month, a lawsuit was filed against a new immigration registration rule from the Trump administration. The new rule requires people in the U.S. without legal status to submit their personal information to an online database. Sydney Fishman reports.
Earlier this month, a lawsuit was filed against a new immigration registration rule from the Trump administration. The new rule requires people in the U.S. without legal status to submit their personal information to an online database. Sydney Fishman has more. One of the first things President Trump did in his office in January was issue an executive order requiring immigrants without legal status to register their information in an online database, under a law passed in 1952. By March, the federal government said the registration was mandatory and that immigrants must carry proof of registration or face imprisonment or a fine of up to $5,000. Green card holders, people with H-1B visas, refugees, and asylum seekers with pending cases do not have to register in the database. On April 10th, a U.S. district judge ruled the Trump administration can move forward with the new law. The new requirement is that immigrants over the age of 14 must register within 30 days of arriving in the United States. Mendocino County immigration attorney Liliana Galelli says the process to register via the online system from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, known by the acronym USCIS, is overwhelming for many immigrants.
None of it is easy. Like, to create a USCIS account is very convoluted.
Galelli says the difficulty of the system has caused frustration among many of her clients.
Just from working with our community, our immigrant community, just getting, you know, a number to text them to is complicated.
The lawsuit was filed by the National Immigration Law Center and the American Immigration Council, two nonprofits that advocate for immigrant rights. The lawsuit argues that the new registration rule is unlawful because it was enforced without the required public comment period, and that it lacks clarity about which categories of immigrants need to register. Sergio Perez is the executive director of Nuestra Alianza de Willits, a Willits-based nonprofit organization. He says he is hopeful the new lawsuit by immigrant organizations can help block Trump's executive order. He says recent victories in court proceedings have stopped the administration from taking away temporary protected status visas from Venezuelans, Cubans, Haitians, and Nicaraguans.
So I think TPS, it will continue. It was supposed to stop in April because the judge from California said that was not legal from the person to do. He canceled that law that Trump wanted to do.
The 1952 Immigration and Nationality Act has long been contested by immigration organizations. Critics argue it favors European immigrants and creates a complex visa system that makes it harder for immigrants to come to the U.S. legally. After the latest federal court decision, the executive order went into effect on April 11th. Following the ruling, the United States Department of Homeland Security released a statement saying the registration requirement will be fully enforced moving forward. This is Sydney Fishman reporting for KMUD News under the California Local News Fellowship.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Sydney Fishman, and Suzanne Potter. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting for KMUD in Redway, I'm Lisa Music.